Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Matsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can hear all of our episodes over on iTunes as well as on DogWorksRadio.com. And today we're joined by an author, public speaker, Arctic explorer, and musher. His name is Joe Henderson. Joe, how's it going?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Robert?
I am fine. Thank you. I know you've been on the show a couple of times, and folks really seem to enjoy having you on. So if you will, Joe, introduce yourself. Tell us who you are and what you're all about.
Okay, yeah, I've been doing the Arctic expeditions on the North Slope of Alaska for probably close to 30 years now, and I use a team of a large team of Malamutes, Alaska Malamutes, and the team's a pretty good team. They hold probably the longest solo record. The longest solo we've done without resupply has been 4 months, which is quite a feat for a team of Malamutes. And we've been exploring the North for a long time, been doing a lot of scientific work up there. But now I'm just specializing, and I take clients out in April and when it's nice and warm. But I still go myself. I head up there in January and February and in March and do my own solos. Take lots of pictures, and that's what we do.
You know, you're pretty active on Facebook. I love seeing the big dogs doing what they do best. How did you get involved with Malamutes? Did you ever use anything other than the big guys?
I've tried several other types. I've tried Greenlands. I've tried all types of different dogs, the old Alaskan Huskies. But the Alaskan Malamutes are just—they're the right size for us. They're a standalone breed. They're one of the most ancient breeds in the world, and they originated on the North Slope, anyhow. So they fit right in. Up there, you have deep snow. Sometimes it's 4 or 5 feet deep, and they have these huge paws, and they can bust that. They can bust that out without a problem. It takes a while, a lot of work for them, but the Greenland dogs are short-legged. They're really good on the coast. And of course, Alaskan Huskies, the old Alaskan Huskies, they weren't as meaty and tough as them, and they had shorter fur. I mean, we're dealing with 100-blow wind chills up there sometimes, hurricane-force winds, and these Alaskan Malamutes, I mean, they are tough, about as tough as you can get.
Right. You know, this is for folks that are listening. I'm sure most of the fans that are fans of the sport of mushing. The Iditarod, the Yukon Quest, recreational type mushing. This is really old school. Get back to the roots type mushing is what you're doing, isn't that right?
Oh yeah, yeah. I never ride on the sled. I mean, I'm always out
right.
On snowshoeing. Yeah. I mean, this is the real deal. I mean, I'll have 22 dogs hooked up. And it depends on where I'm at, what type of hitches I use. I've created quite a different style of hitches. Usually when I'm on the coast, I'll have like 7 or 8 wheel dogs, or dogs in front of the sled, and then kind of five dogs each up there. In the mountains, I'll use 2 dogs abreast, sometimes 3 dogs abreast. And like I said, I'll have 22 of them. They're hauling always at least 2 sleds, sometimes 3, but the sleds are huge. I mean, they're 3 feet wide and 12 foot long, and they can carry a lot. I mean, these sleds, I'll have well over 1,500 pounds in each sled. So, you figure we're going for 3 months without resupply, so we're going to need 3,000 pounds of dog food. And, of course, I'll need some gear myself and groceries. So you're looking at 3,500 pounds between 3 sleds, maybe 2 sleds. It depends on where I'm going. So these guys, yeah, they're tough. They pull, and I know, it's all snowshoe and skiing. Same thing if you were to run a
right.
marathon every day, about the same thing.
So you had mentioned here at the start that you've done a lot of things in the past, some scientific work, some research type work, but you also cater to clients. What are they getting out of this? Is it just more of an expedition type trip? Is it a bucket list thing? What are these folks that come along? What is their reasoning behind it? And what is their job when they are there?
Well, they come from all over the world, and some of them come for the bucket list deal. Some of them come to challenge themselves. The trips itself is it's a self-reliance trip. I mean, once, you know, I show them the works on how to set the tent up, start the fires inside the stoves, gather firewood. You got to remember, there's no trees up there. They're just willow brush. So they have to learn how to do all that. Once they learn these things, they are pretty much on their own. The dogs haul the gear, and that's it. No one rides a sled. No one mushes a team. We just all put on skis or snowshoes and take off, and the dogs follow us with all the gear. And then every night we make camp. So they really learn a lot. They learn about Arctic survival. They learn about the wildlife up there, how to travel, the different types of snow conditions, snow depth. They learn how to, if we're on the coast, we build snow houses. They learn all this. But they come out with a real strong satisfaction of, you know, they've accomplished something they've never done before. And it's not easy. It's not easy. And it's a good deal for everyone. And that's what a lot of my public speaking is about. I mean, these guys have gone for months on end. And the reason I go is I used to go basically for scientific work, to haul gear in for the scientists, and that died off. So I started going for the sheer challenge of it. And it's an ultimate challenge for the human body and mind. I mean, you're basically running a marathon. You're climbing Everest every day, basically what you're doing. You're dealing with 100 below wind chills, hurricane force winds, you know, crevasses, thin ice. I mean, you're dealing with everything you can imagine during the winter. This is when I take my clients. But during the winter,
right?
And then now that I've done all these things, by doing these things and posting pictures and writing books, it's inspiring a lot of people, not only to do these things, but also to challenge themselves and to get out in the wilderness and enjoy life a little bit. And so that's basically what it's turned into now. I do a lot of speaking engagements all over the world now, basically teaching people how to train their dogs, and also how to do, you know, to challenge themselves and to be more, you know, just tough-mindedness and overcome your weaknesses.
Well, I definitely want to talk to you in just a second about your public speaking. I know you have some dates coming up, but I have a question for you about these folks that are signing up for this expedition. If you look on any of the climbing websites, like if you want to climb Rainier or Denali or Everest or whatever, they always say that you have to be in climbing shape before you can even sign up and pay your fee, so to speak. What do you require your folks to do before they sign up? Because, you know, you just can't walk off the street and sign up for something like this and be prepared to, not only enjoy yourself, but be able to make it for a week, two, three, however long your trips are.
Yeah, we have an application they fill out. They have to be able to run a 5K at a certain time. And they do, most people will sign on a year in advance so they can do some jogging and running and skiing and snowshoeing, you know, before they come up. As far as acclimation to the cold, that's really nothing. You can't train for that. That's just where
right.
It is. So we make sure, yeah, they have plenty of gear and take care of them.
So, Joe, for folks that are listening that may not be familiar with the geography of where you're going on your expeditions, can you give us some landmarks? You know, a lot of people are very familiar with Fairbanks. Now they're familiar with Prudhoe Bay, with the ice road truckers on TV and that sort of thing. Where are you going and what general area? I'm sure you're up near the Brooks Range. Is that right?
Yeah, on the north side of the Brooks Range in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is where we concentrate mostly, mainly because it's you know, it's untraveled. You know, we're break trail. We're you know, I've gone as long as 5 months in that area and never have seen another person. It's extremely remote. Yeah, the only way you can get there is break trail. You're dealing with snow that's 3, 4, 5 feet deep. So, you know, your snowshoes really don't do much good. But you have to have the dogs that know how to plow through that stuff. And it's not something the dogs just automatically know. It usually takes a good lead dog 2 years to figure that out. So it takes a long process and a lot of knowledge and understanding of the country to get up in there. Some of the places we go, there's never been a dog team ever recording in those areas. So some of the, you know, the digital photography that you see online, those are some of the first pictures ever taken with a dog team in those areas. It's just, I try to go to the most extreme places possible on the north side of the Brooks Range. And it really pays off. There's some spectacular country up there. I've seen some really, really amazing things as far as landscapes.
You know, I love your pictures. I've been following you for a couple of years on Facebook. I guess it's been 2 or 3 years since you were on the show the first time. It was right when your book came out. So I guess it has been 2 or 3 years. Is that right?
It's been a while, yeah.
So I guess a big question I'm sure a lot of folks have, and maybe you can answer it, maybe you can't. I know that you're able to take care of yourself for months on end, but what happens if you're out there in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of, you know, even though it's March, April, it's still relatively winter up there. What happens if the crap really hits the fan and you're, I don't know, 200-300 miles from the next road or outpost or village or whatever? What do you do?
In regards to the clients, is that what you're asking?
The clients,
yeah.
Or even yourself, you know, if you were to fall and break a femur or something like that, what would you do in that type of situation? I'm sure you got some risk management lined out.
Well, as far as the clients go, yeah, we're pretty well covered. I would never take anyone as far as the extreme places I go. I just wouldn't do it. It's just too much of a risk. But as far as myself, I've learned that, you know, there is no option. I have basically, as I try to tell myself, you know, it's a zero tolerance for making mistakes, and that's the way it has to be. Because if I do break a firmer or whatever, I'm not getting out. I wouldn't, you know.
Right.
Surely the helicopters would come days afterwards or a long time afterwards. I mean, there's just no way. So that's a mindset you have to have when you're in that situation. You know, I never used to travel with even a satellite phone. For many years, I never had any contact. I would go months on end with no contact with the outside whatsoever. I mean, the whole world could be blowing up. I wouldn't even know it. But after doing that, I've trained myself to say, okay, there aren't any mistakes. You cannot make a mistake. And, you know, sometimes you do make mistakes. We're all human. And so I've been in a lot of life and death situations, many. But somehow I always get out of it and work through it. And keep going.
It makes for good stories, doesn't it?
Oh, my gosh. I think that's why people love to go to speaking engagements, because I, you know, I could tell stories all day long, and I don't think I could ever run out.
So here, we're going to jump into that in just a second, but I have one final segment I want to mention, something I just ran across right when I asked you to be on your show, and this is one of the main reasons, is I saw that, I believe coming next summer, you guys are branching out a little bit. You're going to do some different things. I know you're going to do a canoe trip up in the Boundary Waters, and there's some other things. Tell us about those extra expeditions that you've added to the plate, I guess.
Yeah, great. I have a good friend. Her name is Rhonda Schrader, and she is a top-notch wilderness guide. I mean, she is very skilled at traveling in the wilderness and at camping and everything you can imagine when it comes to the wilderness. And, yeah, we're teaming up, and we're going to start with canoe trips in the Boundary Waters of Minnesota in May, and then we're going to move to go to the Yukon River, and we're going to do some canoe trips there. our trips we're offering are 8 to 10 day trips, and they're going to be fantastic. And then we're going to go from the Yukon River up to the North Slope in the Arctic and do raft trips up there. And those will be eight day trips as well. And as usual, we will be going to places where it's very little traveled. I have some favorite rivers up there, some valleys that I love to visit, and they're just not very popular because they're hard to get to, but this is what we're offering. And, yeah, we're really going to go all out on this summer venture, and we hope that we get a lot of people that come along. I mean, we have a passion for the wilderness, and we just want to share it, and this is a great way to do it.
So, Joe, do you think, and this may come into your what you want to talk about on your talks, but do you think, you know, today's society still wants to do things like this? You always hear on the news and whatnot that, you know, the kids are so plugged in, you know, doing their electronic stuff these days. They have no idea what it's like to even be outside. I'm sure you and I, we played outside until the streetlights came on or till mom rang the dinner bell, depending on where you lived. What do you think society feels about Buffeting in 2016 versus, you know, a generation ago?
Yeah, I mean, it's a strong point there, Robert. I mean, people nowadays just, they're disconnected from this type stuff, from nature, from the wilderness, from challenging themselves. And that's what we hope to do, inspire, you know, anyone to get out and discover, you know, my show is Discovering Hidden Strength. I mean, we all have passions, hidden strengths. And when you get out in the wilderness like this, you know, I've watched people really discover, you know, themselves to discover their strength. And they, I've had a lot of people write back and say it changed their entire life after going on a trip with us. It's just, we need to get people out. I mean, you're right. People are getting locked into their digital world computers. And once they get out and get the fresh air, you know, in the breeze and maybe catch some fish in the water, they really start to realize that there's more than just a computer screen in front of them.
Right. You know, when I was growing up, Joe, it was all about, you know, the Boy Scouts and, you know, getting out there and camping and all that stuff. But, you know, my kids, they're in their 20s now, and I tried like heck to get them involved with that, even though we've been a mushing family our whole lives, and they're a little bit more acclimatized to the outdoors than a lot of folks. It seems to be a passe thing now where joining the Boy Scouts and stuff like that just isn't cool anymore. Do you experience that as well?
Yeah, with the younger generation, there's no doubt about it. But, you know, we just got to keep, you know, doing what we do and exposing it, and hopefully get their attention and help them get out. I mean, it's like I said, I've seen a lot of life people change their lives because of getting out, and I guess when you do get out like that, you get a different perspective. You know, when you disconnect from society for a little while, whether it's just 10 days or 5 months, you get a total different perspective on life. And yeah, there's more to it than just, you know, buying the fastest car and getting the best computer. You know.
Right, right. So I know in the next couple of days you're traveling. I don't recall what we talked about. Was it Colorado or Minnesota where you're heading to next?
To Minnesota next to do a speaking engagement, to a presentation. And Rhonda Schrader and I are teaming up on this one. We're going to be talking at the Midwestern Mountain Gear Shop in Minneapolis. And putting on a slideshow there and talking about what we do. I encourage everyone to go to the website at Alaskan Arctic Expeditions or my Facebook page as well, Joe Henderson, Alaskan Arctic Expeditions. I think there are two or three Facebook pages, Team Malamute, you name it. We're all over the place online. But, yeah, and I just came back from Colorado, did the presentation down there at the Alaskan Malamute Club Association. And that was a big event, and we had a blast down there and a good audience, good show. And, yeah, we hope to do more. We're probably be going to overseas next summer to do some Denmark, the UK. But, yeah, people are really interested, particularly about the Malamutes, how to train them, and then, of course, the human aspect of the whole thing of traveling in the Arctic and what it takes, and kind of inspirational, motivational talk as well as instructional informative presentation as well.
You had mentioned that you went to the Malamute Club, and typically, and I was in the Siberian clubs when I was younger for mostly obedience, but also a little bit of confirmation. That's an entirely different world, even from a sport mushing type community. What are those folks focused on that you talk to? Was it show folks? Was it obedience folks? Was it just your typical Malamute owners? And how did you get over that hump when you were talking to them? You know, because as you know, a show Malamute is an entirely different animal than one of your guys that's out there working for 4 or 5 months, without getting a warm bed to sleep in, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I'm surprised that I did get over the hump, but it's all the same. The show dogs, if they go by standard and whatnot, they should be able to perform in the Arctic as well. And so most of my audience that were at those particular presentations, they were curious of exactly what kind of traits that it takes for Malamute to travel in the Arctic. And a lot of them were there to find out the details of what their dog should really look like. You know, AKC has their own idea. It pretty much depends on each judge when they do the shows. But we're trying to save the breed as is, as the real Alaskan Malamute, the large freight dog, and rather than allow them to go down any other route. You know, a lot of people want to race them in long distance races or whatnot. They're not that. They're draft animals. They need to stay large, relatively large, large bones, large paws, heads. You know, they're like a, you know, like a draft horse compared to other dogs,
right,
which would be small horses. So at the show, I basically told them, would show them what my dog looked like and what it takes for a Malamute to travel in the Arctic. These are the requirements. Without these particular traits in a Malamute, there's just no way they can handle it. And from what I've seen at the show, at the AMCA, most of those dogs could do all right in the Arctic. So I think we're in good shape. I think the Malamute breed is pretty good shape. But we just have to keep, there has to be someone to say this won't work in the Arctic and this will. We just got to somehow, obviously no one's traveling in the Arctic with the Malamutes much anymore, except just a few people in the world now. And so somehow we have to, have these people record of what it takes, document it, and hopefully we can keep the breed strong and resilient like they were originally.
And, that's the entire focus. If you read any breed standard, it typically says that somewhere in there. They want to keep that process going. It's to maintain the standard of the breed, whether you're breeding, Siberian Huskies, Malamutes, Cocker Spaniels, Labradors, whatever. They want to make sure that breed remains as best as they can to the original focus. So, Joe, we have just a few more minutes left. I wanted to ask a couple of questions in regards to questions at your talks. You had mentioned that it's a little bit instruction, a little bit inspiration, a little bit, what you do, what you're all about type stuff. What are some of the most interesting questions that you have had asked over the time that you've done these talks? I've done talks myself, and sometimes they're just really off-the-wall questions where you really got to scratch your head to come up with a good answer. Some of them are great questions. Some of them just kind of leave you wondering. What are some really good questions folks have been asking you at your talks?
Oh, there's there's quite a few. But, you know, the funny thing is Malamutes are spirited animals. That's their drive. And they can either turn that, you know, their drive, their energy into fights or pulling. And when they're not pulling, they will, you know, let's face it, they're Malamutes. They're going to fight here and there once in a while. But the most common question I get, in fact, throughout the whole entire show, Julie, is, you know, does your dogs fight? Well, they're Malamutes. Yes, they fight.
Right, right.
But, you know, that is one of the reasons why people don't like to have them is because, you know, they period. But the whole idea of them, you put them in the harness and pulling, is that the reason they're so spirited? Because of the harshness of the pulling. Alaskan Malamutes are draft animals. They want to pull hard. They don't want to run fast. They hate to run fast. But they want to pull something really hard, really heavy. I mean, the average dog team, you know, 100 years ago was only 3 dogs when the Eskimos had them. And they had to pull hard. And
right.
That's what they want to do. If they don't, if that energy isn't into pulling that harness, they want to put the energy someplace else. And that's usually, well, to their neighbor. You know, they're going to snip their neighbor's ear off or something like that. That's just one of the common things I get asked all the time. I try to explain it to, yeah, that's the way life is with a Malamute. They like to, but once you put them in the harness and they're pulling a good pull, they forget all about that fighting. And it really helps to let people know that, hey, they're draft animals. They need to pull something hard, heavy. I mean, load up your sled, put 1,000 pounds in it. They can pull it without a problem, and they enjoy it. When their tails are up and they're smiling, they're loving life. And as you can see in all my pictures, I mean, these guys are pulling 2,000 or 3,000 pounds in those pictures and breaking trail, and they're all smiles. They live for it.
You know, Joe, a typical race sled for long-distance mushing is probably 100 pounds or less. I can only imagine how tough it must be to haul 1,000 or up to 3,000 pounds of gear. That's got to be an enormous amount of weight. How many dogs do you have stretched out on that 1,000-pound sled? You know, with us, it's typically 10, 12, 14, maybe 16 dogs if you're doing Iditarod. What do you have lined out on a 1,000-pound sled?
Well, they're more than 1,000 pounds, but that'd be a light load. I wish it could only be 1,000 pounds. But I use 22 dogs. 22 dogs is the team I use, and each sled, when I take off, like last year, I went on a 40-day solo expedition, unsupported, which meant that was probably 2,500 pounds of gear. So, yeah, they're hauling a ton most of the time. And, yeah, that's an enormous amount of weight, and they're breaking trail. So it's just
right.
These guys are tough. And it's really in-depth. I mean, the training is totally different when people think. You know, you think, well, you got to condition them to do all this. Not with these guys, not with freight pulling. It's all psychological training, 100% in their heads. And that's really, you have to really know, you know, you have to get inside their heads. And that's what it's all about. It's all about trust, you know. If they trust
right.
you, they love you. And if you have a bond, a connection with them, they'll do anything for you. But you can break that trust so easy, and that basically breaking trust if you overwork them. And that's where your trust will be broken. And sure, there's still pull, but they won't pull 100%, and you're never pull that 3,000-pound load. So that's what it's all about.
Right.
And it's all about reading body languages and the dogs all day long, making sure they're always smiling, the tails are always up. You got to pay attention to the humidity, the temperatures, the type of snow. I mean, there's a lot of things you have to really consider, because the Malamutes aren't going to tell you when they're getting tired. They're going to keep pulling. But they're going to wake up the next morning sore, and they're going to hold back. And that's the last thing you can do, is have a team that holds back when you're out in the middle of nowhere and you're in a snowstorm, and you got to get back. I mean, you can't have them slack off. I mean, they got to want to do it, so... It's a big process.
Right.
And plus, you're going, you know, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, they have to do it for weeks on end. This isn't, you know, a 200-mile qualifier race for Iditarod where it's over in a weekend. You're out there for a month or more, and those guys have to get up every morning and go the next however many miles you're going that day. It's truly a job, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. They're going for 3.5 to 4 months solid. And my goal, which is we accomplished every year, is you know how it is when you hook up a team in the fall time for the first time, how excited they are. On the very last day of the expedition, they're just as excited as they are on the first day. That is what I work towards, and every year we accomplish it. Otherwise, if you don't do that, the following year, those dogs are going to remember, and they're going to hold back. You'll never be able to go to the places where you really want to go and see the things you want to see if those dogs are holding back. They have to love it, and it's play for them. It's 100% play. It's not work to them at all. You know, the way I look at it is I'm not a dominant male alpha or whatever you call it. I'm a team member, and that's where they look at me, a team member. A lot of times I'll hook myself up right with the wheel dogs and help pull up the hill. They see that. They recognize that. I'm not a dominating figure. The only reason they go where they go is because there's a mutual bond of love, respect for each other, and that's the only way we can do this. Otherwise, yeah, you'd be working your dogs, and they just wouldn't want to go.
Spoken from a true dog man for sure. Joe Henderson is our guest today. Joe, we are out of time. I know you had mentioned you had several Facebook pages out there. What's the best way folks can get a hold of you so they can drop you a line, follow you, and really see what's happening up in your neck of the woods?
Yeah, I just go to Joe Henderson at the Facebook, and all you'll find me. If you go Google Joe Henderson Malamute Man Alaska or something like that, it'll come up. You'll find me. But yeah, just go to my personal page and then message me there. And then from there, I have other sites that we can direct you if you want to go on a trip or especially the summer trips. You really want to get these summer trips going too. So,
well, I'm going to do my best to place some links on our page here, in particular, your summer expeditions. I really thought that was a cool thing to be offering. Joe, it's always been a pleasure. Hopefully we aren't strangers for the next couple of years. Seems like every couple of years I have you on the show. So thanks a lot for being on, and good luck with your talk there in Minnesota this week.
All right. Thanks a lot, Robert. Appreciate it.
Thank you. So my guest today is Joe Henderson. Check him out on Facebook or just search the web for him, Joe Henderson Malamute or Team Malamute, and you can find them there. We look forward to talking to you guys next time. Goodbye.